Who invented the alphabet, and why does knowing the answer help archaeology?
Our special guest Danny Bate is here to explain how understanding language can help better understand the past.
It's all coming up on the Time Team podcast.
Yes, welcome to this week's Time Team podcast with Helen Geek and Martin Williams, where we had a fantastic response to our last episode, where we revealed the exciting news about the double burial we discovered on our princely burial excavation at Cherrington. We had so many messages reacting to Jackie McKinley's revelation that the young boy and girl who were buried together were brother and sister.
The wonders of DNA have allowed us to understand the relationship between the two people in that grave like never before. And Jackie was hypothesising, wasn't she, Helen, that it's likely that the siblings died at the same time, perhaps from a disease or infection that one passed to the other. The messages that you've been sending us on this have just been a pleasure to read, and I wanted just to mention a handful of them now. Jeanette says it really does give a whole new level of understanding to the graves, giving a glimpse of what actually happened. Christopher here says a fascinating scientific result, and I wonder if there's any chance of recovering the DNA of the possible pathogen as well. That's very interesting. Helena says so sad and moving, and that I think is an interesting thought about the emotion behind it as well, which we can't forget. These are real people, and knowing that relationship between them seems to bring them to life in a way that just talking about their remains doesn't. The level of interest we've had in this discovery has astounded us, really. And I think we need to maybe get Jackie back on the podcast soon. Maybe we do like a bonus episode with her for our Time Team members at Project Supervisor level and above. I might try and do that maybe next week or something like that. So if you're able to, do consider signing up at patreon.com/timeteamofficial.
Yes, and it's so lovely to hear those comments for me, because I've been studying Anglo-Saxon burials, you know, for almost the last 40 years. And sometimes you can get to the point where you feel that they're just another bit of data. You know, each one is really helpful, each one is different, and that you're building up this picture. And you forget to see them as human beings. You forget to see them as little individual human tragedies. And that's how they're meaningful at the time that they were made. And so even if you are a hard-headed archaeologist, you've still got to remember the human effect if you're trying to reconstruct human society, if you like. So it's so good for me to hear other people's views. So thank you very much for all those comments.
I feel like it's something that we are, yeah, definitely going to return to at some point. But right now, I think we need to focus on today's podcast. And it's a bit of a special one, actually. Helen and I we found ourselves increasingly interested in linguistics and language and word origins and etymology, haven't we, Helen? In fact, when you and I were at Brancaster together, you were constantly looking stuff up in the etymology dictionary. Like anyone says anything on a dig in a trench and you're like, oh, I can find the answer to this. I wonder where that word comes from. It's interesting stuff, isn't it? So when we got word that linguist, writer and broadcaster Danny Bates had written a book all about it, we jumped at the chance to invite him on the podcast for a chat.
Yes, and that's because I think understanding the words, the language that's used by the people whose lives we investigate through archaeology, it can give us a much better understanding of how they thought and they felt, not just what they say, but how they said it. And it can tell us so much about the relationships they had with the other people around them.
And Danny's book, which looks at all of that and loads more, is called Why Q Needs You. And it's out in the UK now and is coming out in the US in June. Danny, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. This is surreal because I'm a huge fan of Time Team. Always have been for many years. I don't want to call myself a child of Time Team. I think that would raise speculations about my parentage, but I'm of the Time Team generation, the sort of kids who would watch it and then go out into the garden and dig a test pit or something like that. And if I'd been a little bit older, I would have tried to be on it somehow as a pot washer or fence keeper or something like that.
Yeah, I did exactly the same thing. I was sort of out in the back of the garden burying roof tiles and then rediscovering them again with sort of little trowels and brushes and things like that. I think a lot of people of our generation perhaps did that. What was it about time team then, Danny, that got you sort of interested and made you fall in love with the programme?
Honestly, hard to say. I do have to put that front and centre in that it's just one of those ingredients that form your personality and maybe like some sort of archaeological base strata, it's quite hard to get back to. But I remember loving it. I remember looking forward to it. I mean, my family are a very historically, archaeologically minded family. If I dug a test pit in the garden, my mum wouldn't have minded so much because she herself was been an archaeologist. She volunteered, for example, at the Sedgefoot digs in Norfolk, for example. So there's archaeology in my DNA, you could say, and hi, mum. But it was just one of those things. And I think there is something even beyond the archaeology that appeals to me, and that is the detective work. It's the sleuthing that I love piecing together a picture, a theory, a story from few scraps of evidence. And that is the thing that excites me about archaeology. But I didn't actually pursue it. I pursued linguistics instead, historical linguistics, but it's still that same feeling of taking bits and fragments and trying then to form the whole.
And your new book, Why Q Needs You, it's all about the alphabet. It's all about the individual letters, but it's absolutely stuffed full of archaeology. Can you explain why it is that archaeology has this amazing gift to give to historical linguistics?
Absolutely. I mean, the short answer is that if it weren't for archaeology, our understanding of the alphabet's history would be quite short. There wouldn't be much of it in that we are dependent on archaeological sources for tracking its development over history. Of course, today we have historical sources and written documents, but these can only take us so far back into the past. To start things off at the very beginning, the alphabet, and I should preface this by saying I'm not talking about all alphabets or all writing, but rather one particular tradition to which English's alphabet belongs. This has its origins in ancient Egypt, in the Middle Kingdom of ancient Egypt, and we don't have documents that you could call historical that could exemplify the alphabet. We have archaeological documents. We have finds, bits of pots or engravings, inscriptions on the wall of a cliff or on a ceramic sphinx and things like this. And so archaeology is absolutely key to tracking this story because it's archaeology that's given us the evidence.
These are really minute, aren't they, in some cases? I mean, I was really taken in the book by how you hang quite a lot on an inscription that's actually only two words long. And we think one is a name and the other one means priest. And even that is quite uncertain. I mean, it's definitely not a fixed story, is it? So much could change, as with everything to do with archaeology.
Yes, absolutely. And it's entirely in flux. I would only add that two words is not bad for historical linguistics. So, you know, I've made do with less in my research, to be honest. A single letter would be fantastic sometimes. But of course, it is fascinating and it is an active debate. And the big theories can feel exciting, but also a little bit fragile in that they could change. A single find could upset the whole story. And I've tried to incorporate that sense of uncertainty into my writing. It's not fixed. I say a single find could upset the story. It has threatened to in recent history. I'll give the example of the process of writing my book, which is that the most difficult chapter by far for me to write was actually chapter A, the initial chapter, which I lay out the earliest history of the alphabet. And it's complicated. I somehow have to understand, summarize, and make accessible an academic field where no one could really agree on anything because they're working with these scraps of evidence and so many theories are possible. But with the help of a friend over in the Netherlands who's an expert and working in this field, I got the chapter, the first draft, to a comfortable state. And I thought, right, now I can carry on to chapter B. 2 months later, I'm on the bus and you get one of those Google news alerts and it says, find that threatens alphabetic history discovered in Syria. And it's just...
Oh, no!
It's a gut punch. It's a gut punch, I tell you. I get off the bus, I race home, I read as much of the articles as I can, and the fear eventually subsides, and I would summarise this new development as important, but not a definite contribution to the story just yet. The kind of facts surrounding this new find are uncertain, written, and it could eventually, it didn't, the chapter didn't need to be rewritten. It was just a matter of a footnote at the end of the day.
Yes, I'm constantly telling the joke that goes, how many archaeologists does it take to change a light bulb? We don't know, we haven't got enough evidence yet. And it sounds like historical linguistics is much the same. I love a discipline that's always got the possibility of change. There's always something new to find out.
Absolutely.
I suppose that's the way that archaeology can help linguistics. But linguistics helping archaeology, I wonder, because there's a real well-researched development of the alphabet of writing that would really help in dating. If only you could find something in the ground with something written on it, you would be able to assist with the dating of things based on, you know, the letters that we use, the word order. Are there any other ways that linguistics might be able to help archaeology, you know, the other way around?
Yeah, I mean, so the relationship between the two is not unidirectional. It's a very mutually nourishing relationship. All the great stuff that you archaeologists know about dating helps us linguists, because we can say that the first alphabetic writing that we have from Egypt is in a particular context, a particular find site. Most of the evidence comes from the Sinai Peninsula. And, you archaeologists tell me, when people are active mining for stuff in this part of the Egyptian Empire, but it can go in the other direction. So, you know, the level of language, you can maybe say, we're always trying to date things. There's a lot of relative chronology in historical linguistics, where this sound change needed to have happened before this sound change, and this helps us to pinpoint which people, where they were, how much they had spread out from each other, and that could be of use for archaeologists.
I think one of the other things about the evidence you present in the book is that I was really taken by how much languages like art or fashion or something like that, in that it moves because of the difference in relationships, and it transmits itself because one way of talking is more prestigious than another, which is exactly the same as happens in costume and in art styles and in styles of weaponry and pottery and so on and so forth. It's all to do with who you want to emulate, who you want to be seen as being like, and who you want to shun and you don't want to be seen as being like. And that really amazed me, how like it is to any other kind of inquiry into the past. Have you always known that? Have you always known how like archaeology it is? Or is it something you've picked up by this specific study?
Well, I wasn't born with this information, so I must have acquired it at
well,
some
not.
Point.
I mean, that's not the impression you
no,
give.
No, sadly. I said archaeology was in my DNA. I don't think it goes that that specific. But it's true. It's something that you pick up as a kind of intuition, a sense as a linguist. I think there's an archaeologist sense of what is possible, what theories are possible, and the same is gradually acquired within linguistics as well. This is acquired not only through focusing on history specifically, but also the subfield of sociolinguistics, which is all about exactly what you say. These networks of prestige. We love the word prestige. We can't get enough of it. It's like ritual in archaeology. We're always talking about prestige. What's people looking up, people looking down within society, people trying to get away, people trying to raise themselves up, etc., etc. And this is expressed in every single facet of language ever. I love the idea of fashion in particular. I love that parallel between the two, because there is a sense that fashions can cross linguistic lines and cultural lines. And that would be particularly true of, say, the alphabet. You do see in the history of the alphabet, its progress, its passing through different cultures, many of whom actually speak wildly different languages. So one of the key jumps in the history of the alphabet is the jump from the Phoenicians to the Greeks. The Phoenicians, based in the Levant, in what's now Lebanon, they are almost certainly the people who handed the alphabet onto the Greeks. And from that point onwards, we get alphabetic Greek writing. Not the first Greek writing, that's Linear B, but that dies away because Linear B is attached to the circumstances of Mycenaean Greece. The alphabet comes in, and through all these different stopping off points, you can see some tension. You can see innovation, where the different languages and cultures are trying to make the alphabet work better for them. So the Greeks absolutely did this. The Greeks added vowel letters. That's a pretty big thing to do. But also a slight tension and not wanting to move too far away from the people that you got the alphabet from. Because of prestige, of the fact that the Phoenicians are very impressive, and then, for, you know, impressive to the Greeks, and then the Greeks are pretty impressive to the Romans, and the Romans don't want to move too far from the Greeks' version of the alphabet. They would probably begrudgingly admit that the Greeks are pretty cool. And then, of course, in the post-classical world, I would say this is then taken up a whole notch, because really, I would say that the story of post-classical alphabetic writing, post the Romans, has been one where really, really reluctant to move too far away from the Roman version of the alphabet. Like, English desperately needs either multiplication of letters where you're combining them to spell more sounds, or indeed new letters. And we refuse to take that step. The Romans and Greeks and Phoenicians would have had no problem in creating letters from scratch. But we, people in the post-Roman West, in languages like English, have been very reluctant to do that because the Romans are prestigious. The Rome casts a long shadow.
And so that will help us, won't it? Think about how, why do some art styles, some objects, some ways of living change very quickly? And why do others go on and on and on for thousands of years? The prestige of the past can turn into the prestige of the future. Because I've always been struck by how incredibly strong the alphabet that we use is. I mean, I can accept that there are little changes in German has the odd extra letter and French has got all its accents and so on. But our use of it is very pervasive. Whereas I have a friend from Georgia, and she says she grew up thinking that every language had its own alphabet because she'd learnt Georgian and Russian and Greek and English, four alphabets for four languages. Because we use the Latin alphabet and it's turned into the English alphabet and the prestige of Rome and now the prestige of English, has our alphabet stopped changing?
That's a good question. If I were to answer in any way with confidence, of course, I would immediately be proved wrong in the near future. This is the big question at the moment. And I firstly would say that we are, from my perspective, living through an era of writing, of alphabetic writing. What I mean by that is your listeners, people who may be familiar with historical sources or paleography, can recognize, you can sense, aha, I have a vague sense of what period this particular bit of writing comes from. And our era is no different. I think there are defining features of our era, such as, for example, our huge standardization of writing, a real reduction in variation according to accent and dialect in a way that is made possible because of current technology, spell checker, AI, things that are really enforcing a standard in ways that just weren't possible in the past. And I can see this continuing at least for a good while longer until something else comes along. That could be facilitated by a change in technology. That could also equally be facilitated by a change in geopolitics. Let's say that English-speaking countries lose their political, cultural dominance. English could go a similar way. And I don't want to labour the point, but I think then we might then be in a sort of, I could hesitantly draw a parallel with Latin, in that Latin and a standard way of writing Latin is very powerful. It's backed up by the Roman state in the West. But as that state fragments and becomes new countries, Latin never goes anywhere, but new languages are able to rise to the surface and get written down as well. We call these the Romance languages. They're descendants of Latin. And if, for example, the whole situation changed and this super standardized English spelling dissipated in power or strength, it would kind of be the end of the English language, I would say. It's one of the few things holding English together at this point. And a new family of Anglian languages in America, Canada, South Africa, India, Ireland might then come to the fore. But now that I've said that, it won't happen.
No, but it's a really interesting point. And I think the parallels with Latin are fascinating. I think we've long heard of this idea of a kind of Britannic style of Latin that was spoken here. And of course, Latin would have been, at the time of the Romans and their occupation of this bit of the world, would have been the language of dominance, but it certainly wouldn't have been the language that was spoken by the majority of the population.
isn't that still something that we don't really know? I mean, Danny, what is your view on the language spoken in Roman Britain? Because it does seem extraordinary that with 400 years of a really quite high population producing a lot of stuff, the inscriptions that we have from Roman Britain, the language that we have, are quite biased. They don't seem to be from every level of society. So we're not sure what every level of society was actually speaking. Is that right?
I'm tearing up here. I can't believe I get the chance to talk about Latin in Britain. This is this is Christmas from my perspective. It's calling it a pet theory. So it's a great question. And I love this topic because it's the perfect example of what I alluded to at the beginning, of that sense in me of building a convincing picture with not much evidence. And I firstly want to acknowledge that it is a bit odd that we don't have more inscriptions from southern or lowland Britain that exemplify the Latin language as we do from, you know, from the rest of the world. I am of the opinion, I think I'm not alone in this, but I will also say it's not the only opinion, that Latin was definitely a native language of Britain at some point. It was especially concentrated in the south, in places closest to Rome. And as you went further north within Britain, you would reach other languages that would have been suffused in Latin words, Latin sounds, to a decreasing degree. So the further north you go. Evidence for this, of course, is limited. It could well be that they're just lost, that we would have had more, but the upsets of the, you know, of the arrival of the Angles and Saxons and whoever they were destroyed the evidence, or that's odd. I will fully admit that it's weird, but there are other sources of evidence beside historical texts, which are other languages. So Welsh, for example, looks like the speech of, I mentioned, of that slightly more northern zone, of a kind of Brython, a Celtic language that was already on the scene, where people are clearly speaking language as a second language. They're adopting words, even basic words sometimes, but it's not fully replacing Welsh. And Welsh looks like, that's why I love it so much, a kind of layer of British language, Roman British language, preserved in aspic, that just happens to be preserved. As you went further north, moving away from whatever was happening at Hadrian's Wall, you'd then cross into what's now Scotland, and you'd have Pictish, which for all intents and purposes is basically a sister of Welsh, but it probably had much fewer Latin words in it. So you have a kind of spectrum of completely Latin to not really Latin up the length of Britain. But piecing together that picture is fraught with controversy, and there are experts who would happily disagree with me on that.
And the Latin itself that was being spoken in the south, I mean, I mentioned that I thought that there were theories about it being a particular type of Latin, a Britannic Latin. How much evidence is there of that, that they would have spoken Latin in a way that would have been maybe slightly different to the Latin that was spoken in Rome?
Great question. So the finds that we have for Britain actually point to a somewhat conservative kind of Latin, a classical kind of Latin, which perhaps means that they needed some sort of education. There was still a tradition of learning proper Latin, because the finds which we have inscriptions of Latin right through the Dark Ages and out into the other side. We have standing stones from Wales, for example, that use the Latin grammatical endings perfectly right, you know, as Cicero and Caesar would see it. And the evidence from Welsh, so words are being taken into Welsh or what becomes Welsh with certain sounds, also indicates that British Latin was somewhat conservative as a form of speech, somewhat conservative. So changes that are happening on the continent and maybe are centralized in Italy and southern France and Spain, and that would in time become the Romance language, is as these little differences build up, we don't really have evidence for them in Welsh, which almost is like preserving a silhouette or a shadow of British Latin, of British Latin as it was spoken. So, for example, we don't find the velar sounds at the back of the mouth, so your sounds k and g, we don't find them being palatalized into something like ch and j or ts. So these are sounds that happen in the history of Italian and French. We've got no evidence for them in Welsh. We do have evidence for people dropping their ends in the middle of a word, so a word like mensa, table, becoming mesa, which is fine. That's a normal change to happen. But the Welsh words that we do have, they appear to be in a certain case of Latin, not the nominative, the first case, if people are familiar with that, which maybe hints at the same disintegration of the case system of Latin that we do see everywhere else. So British Latin, because of this kind of silhouette, is basically the same as spoken language across the Western Roman Empire, but maybe a little bit conservative or old-fashioned in its sounds.
That seems kind of intuitively slightly right for Britain being a bit of a backquarter of the Roman Empire. You do wonder, I found myself wondering whether if you intuitively see yourself as living in a bit of a backwater, maybe you do tend to go for the more old-fashioned forms of language. It's also tied up with the emotional way in which you see yourself and your neighbours.
And doesn't Britain send some emperors off, you know, to go try be emperor somewhere else? I mean, they see themselves as properly Roman, able to raise up an emperor and send him off across the coast. So I was just going to add to that, we do have great literary texts as well, which show that people did know proper Latin still. It was still varied. I'm not talking about different languages here. We're thinking more about different registers of the same language. So in daily speech, you might mix up your nominative and accusative, but in something like the literary language of St. Patrick, who leaves us two historical texts, St. Patrick raised in somewhere in Britain, it's good Latin. I've got to stop using these quotation marks, but it's good classical Latin. So all of this is going on in the UK or in Britain. You just have to search for it.
It's a bit like DNA, actually. This is reminding me of the study of DNA, that you can take as your comparison modern DNA, which is much easier to get. And obviously, it's really easy to study modern languages and how they have evolved up to the present day. But the Holy Grail really is ancient DNA, and the Holy Grail for the historical linguist is the piece of writing that shows what the original situation was like. You can extrapolate all you like from what's around today, but what you really need is the archaeological information, whether that's for DNA or for language.
Absolutely, yeah. It could be some sort of find that is in unusual context, so it's not meant as a kind of monument, it's everyday language, such as what we find from Vindolanda. And on behalf of all historical linguists, may I just make a short plea to basically say, if you are going to write some texts and bury them in the ground so that they survive, please make lots of mistakes, please, because they're really helpful. It's only through spelling mistakes that we find out what people actually spoke like at the time.
Yes, because the role of dyslexics in this has not been mentioned yet.
Yes. Why has nobody spoken about the dyslexics? Absolutely. Helen, we're talking about the importance of finding these examples archaeologically, but how rare is that? Because I've, you know, on the few digs I've been on now, never has something come up with something written on it.
It's incredibly rare. I did a talk about 15 years ago on all of the objects with runes on them that had been recorded by the Portable Antiquities Scheme. And I think it was maybe half an hour long. You know, it really wasn't a very long talk. And I encompassed every single one. There have been a few more found since then, but they're always cause for enormous excitement and celebration. And something that has the Latin alphabet on it, like the inscription from the Staffordshire Hoard, that makes everybody absolutely delirious with excitement. And it's pored over by everybody, by epigraphists, by paleographers, by linguists, by everybody. They're so exciting to find anything with an inscription on, right up until the point where you get printing. I've told you, well, we've talked about lots of seal matrices on this podcast, Martin, and perhaps I ought to think of another one to share with everybody. But they are so seductive to archaeologists because they have sometimes names, so they give you an individual, and sometimes little mottos, so they give you a window into what people are thinking and what language they're thinking in, which in the 14th and 15th centuries can vary from English to French to Latin. But they are so rare that we get completely overexcited by all of them right up until the end of the medieval period, really.
But why are they so rare? That's what I don't quite understand, because I would have thought if you are purposely putting something in the ground, I understand that obviously there's a lot in archaeology that isn't purposely put in the ground for people to find, but if you are, you know, doing a burial or something like that, why aren't people writing things like we would maybe put something, an inscription, an engraving on a coffin, for example?
It's a good question. I don't think that there are that many people who do put that many inscriptions on things. I think I'm quite unusual in whenever people say, what would you have buried with you? I say, I don't want a thing. I want a coffin plate that tells you how old I was, what I did for a living, major diseases, number of children, anything that would help. It's a conscious transmitting of information. And if you look around your house at all of your objects, hardly any of them have lettering, have a message on them. Coins do, of course, and they're very prescribed, they're very stereotyped. You get the same thing on every coin, so they're not the most helpful thing. Although, Danny, I did notice when you're discussing the runic letter for th, is that the thorn?
Mm-hmm, thorn.
That turns up on coins and can stump the novice because they think that this is being spelt with a D and they don't notice the little line across it. So coins do have a bit to tell you. But on the whole, I think most of what we have doesn't have very much in the way of message on it. Something that happened in the 1990s, you kept getting ceramics with the words of the thing that they were designed to hold, so that you'd get a mug with tea, coffee written around the edge, and you'd get a plate with breakfast, dinner, lunch and tea written around the edge. And you now have those things that you can stick on your wall that says things like
live, laugh, love.
Exactly. And you can get little signs that say you don't have to be mad to work here, but it helps.
Yeah.
We do seem to be now, since perhaps the 1990s, saying more in this passive way. But I think in the past, people just said it, you know, came out of your mouth and it disappeared. Writing is the permanent form of speech, but speech is the most fugitive thing there is. Once it's come, it's gone, unless it's something like a podcast that you can listen to over and over again. Oh, that makes me shiver a bit, that my words aren't immediately disappearing into the ether.
Yeah, the majority of human linguistic output, the vast majority, is just lost forever, which is a fact I don't dwell on. I am now fretting that archaeologists of the future will characterise 21st century Britain according to its three virtues of live, laugh and love in the future, which is a terrifying thought.
I couldn't think of anything worse.
I would just like to, or for example, like people had dogs and they really praise the fact that this dog lives here. And he guards a particular type of dog, and this was our very canine centered culture.
Yeah.
But I would just add as well that this is a secondary factor, but by no means dismisses yours. But it's a factor that compounds the problem, which is the problem of perishable materials. And this is extraordinarily relevant for the history of the alphabet. It remains relevant to this day that we are working with the things that have survived, and it is entirely possible. In fact, it is more likely that certain stages of alphabetic history were actually the let's say the innovations, the major movements were happening on perishable materials such as papyrus that in most cases just hasn't survived. I'll give a particular example that is very current, is that basically, as I mentioned, we have the Phoenicians in ancient history who passed the alphabet on to the Greeks. And there is a project that has just started up or will just start up very shortly in reevaluating all the evidence that we have and pushing the Greek acquisition of the alphabet back in time. And the idea basically being that, yes, our sources for Greek alphabetic writing start after 800 BC, but those are just the ones that have survived. And all of this indirect evidence, such as the shape of the letters, not so much what they're used for, but the way that letters look and the way that they're used on the page, that you have different directions of writing, you have left to right, right to left, boustrophedon, where it's snaking its way around the page, or it's just lost. And this is an ongoing project, and I'm very sympathetic to this hypothesis that the alphabet arrived among the Greeks earlier. We just lack the evidence for it.
So how is that going to be proved?
It won't. I mean, I suppose I can sit comfortably with this. I very so rarely use the word prove or proof or anything like that. My whole PhD is in the word order of a language that is so old we don't have any direct evidence for it. So I'm more than happy with just sitting with just nice theories and hypotheses and that sort of thing.
And circumstantial evidence, I suppose, that will
sure,
come out.
Yeah. General yeah, principles yeah. Like Proto-Indo-European, the one I researched, it probably had word order, and here's what it could have been.
that's something else that I've never understood about what I feel are complicated languages like Latin. Our story of how Latin develops in the medieval world and later is a constant theme of simplification. Take away this, take away that, take away the other. I think that's really easy to see that if you've got a difficult language, you take away some aspects of it. But how did those aspects start in the first place? Who added them all into Latin? Because obviously there is no point at which somebody designs a language. One language evolves out of another. So if it's a constant simplification, how does anything ever get complicated? And I suspect here, this is slightly my problem, because as I'm always telling people, I don't have an O level in biology. So I don't really understand how evolution of anything works.
Yes. So the problem with this view of language as a sort of general trend of decreasing complexity is that it does imply some sort of linguistic genius back in time that had the ultimate super language, and we've been fading away from that ever since. It's a sort of Tolkien-esque view of world history where it all just gets worse as things go on. The evidence doesn't support that, or it could support that view with a single modification. You can basically say that things do get less complex if you're specifically talking about words, the way that you build up a word. How long can a word be? What does a single instantiation of vocabulary include? But if you stretch to all complexity, that general hypothesis just doesn't hold. Because let's take Latin. Latin famous for its endings. Other ways of building words are available. You can put things at the beginning as well. That's fine. But you'll take something like amabam, meaning I was loving. It functions as a single word, but you can divide it up into ama, that gives you the love bit, ba, which gives you the was, like ongoing aspect bit, and the m at the end, which is I, first person singular. English has all of those ingredients. They're just separate words. So what's happened is that the words have lost maybe some structural complexity, but what the words themselves have lost, word order and sentences have gained. They've gained more words. So we've now gone from amabam to a sort of modern European generally perspective where it's not one word but three, I was loving. The ingredients have not gone anywhere. The difference is, do we join them up into these extra long and extra complex words?
So one person's complexity is actually another person's simplicity.
Oh, yeah.
Rather like the German way of making those words with lots of words added together. It sounds complicated to us because it's a very long word. But in English, it would be a sentence, which would sound much more complicated to perhaps if you're German.
Now you're getting it. This is
Thank
the linguistic
you.
Intuition.
Well, Danny, it's just been so interesting learning, well, more about etymology and linguistics, but particularly how they can help archaeology and vice versa, which I found so interesting. You can learn more about that in Danny's brand new book, Why Cute Needs You, which is out in the UK right now.
Yes, it is a really fantastic book. And thank you, Danny, so much for coming on to talk about the whole subject of historical linguistics and how it helps us study the past.
I think you can tell how much this means to me. So thank you very much for having me.
And that's all we have time for this week. Don't forget that you can get so much more from Time Team by becoming a member and supporting the archaeology we undertake up and down the country. Go to patreon.com/timeteamofficial for exclusive clips, bonus podcast episodes, 3D models, masterclasses, and early releases of Time Team episodes.
Next week, we're back on the Mapperton Estate, learning how our ex-crew team used geophysics to get a better understanding of the building they hoped to investigate on site. Plus, find out how you can trace your family heritage with ancient maps.
That's all next week, where we'll also see you on YouTube for another edition of the Time Team podcast. Bye.
Bye-bye.